Is the pandemic finally over? The World Health Organization says COVID-19 is no longer a global health emergency. But that includes a caveat. The virus is here to stay. So what lessons have been learned from one of the most devastating diseases in history? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tom McRae. After being in place for more than 3 years, the World Health Organization has declared COVID-19 is no longer a global health emergency. It's a major step towards the official end of the pandemic that's killed millions of people, ravaged communities, and disrupted the world's economy. It will now be up to governments to manage the outbreak any way they think best. Fidia Carr reports.
After the deaths of an estimated 20 million people and more than 3 years of restrictions around the planet, the World Health Organization says the pandemic is no longer a global health emergency.
The worst thing any country could do now is to use this news as a reason to let down its guard, to dismantle the systems it has built, or to send the message to its people that COVID-19 is nothing to worry about.
The UN agency first declared COVID-19 to be what is called a public health emergency of international concern in January 2020. About 765 million infections have since been recorded worldwide. And the death toll reached a peak of more than 100,000 people a week in January 2021.
This is a moment for reflection. COVID-19 has left and continues to leave deep scars on our world. Those scars must serve as a permanent reminder of the potential for new viruses to emerge with devastating consequences.
The WHO's call reflects a decline in cases, a lower rate of deaths, and greater immunity to the virus among the global population. More than 7 million people are confirmed to have died. But the WHO believes the actual figure could be about three times that. Governments first responded to the pandemic with lockdowns and travel restrictions. But with a new vaccine technology based on mRNA, they quickly launched vaccination campaigns. And 13 billion doses have been given to people around the planet. Yet most haven't received one. So is it possible to say the pandemic is now over? And how big is the threat the world could face another? Fidia Carr for Inside Story.
Well, let's get to the thoughts of our guests now. Joining me in Rabat is Azzedine Ibrahimi, Professor of Medical Biotechnology and Director of the Mohammed VI Centre for Research and Innovation. In Doha is Dr. Patrick Tang, Division Chief of Microbiology at Sidra Medicine. And in Copenhagen is Jeff Lazarus, Professor of Global Health at CUNY Graduate School of Public Health and Health Policy. He is also a former Senior Technical Officer for Communicable Diseases for the World Health Organization. A warm welcome to all three of you. Thank you very much for being here on Inside Story. Jeff, if I can begin with you, please, being a former WHO employee. Do you think that this is a confusing or conflicting message from the WHO? I mean, saying on one hand it's no longer a public health emergency, but also trying to convince people and governments around the world to still consider this a very real threat.
I think it's a very confusing message for most people, some governments, but certainly for the general public. We have to remember that WHO declared the public health emergency of international concern in the context of the international health regulations, when there's a health threat that presents such a big risk to other countries in terms of spread of infection and mortality, that it calls on countries to collaborate internationally. So we've already passed that point. So in the context of IHR, and as was already mentioned, the declining mortality and the increased immunity due to the vaccines, it's seen that now, although it's not an emergency, it's still considered by WHO to be a major public health threat. So I think there's some confusion and we need to get clarity on the importance of addressing the pandemic treaty that's in progress and maintaining high levels of vaccination so we don't see mortality increase again.
Ezzedine, what is the risk, if there is any, if people think that the pandemic is over when there are still, I think the WHO said yesterday, that there is still one person dying every 3 minutes from COVID-19?
My colleague from Denmark, actually, I think the pandemic is still here somehow, but I think the WHO was actually forced to do that because in most countries, and I'm talking from the African countries, most of them actually abandoned and actually left out all the restriction for the COVID-19. But I think as a scientist, and here we have to be humble actually, and that's one of the lessons that we have to get through what we lived through the COVID is humility. And I think the virus is still here. There is a possibility that can be some really new kind of changes, mutation on the virus, and that could be coming back. But on the other hand, I think we have to start thinking about the post-COVID because that will be more important. I think the lesson that we have to take from the COVID are very important. But beside that, we have to think next, what we do next. And I think there is a couple of lessons that we have to take in consideration and prepare and be ready maybe for the next pandemic while we are getting out of this one.
Yeah, we're certainly going to get delve into what has been learned and the mistakes that have been made from COVID-19. Dr. Tang, I mean, has the WHO, have we as I guess the world, have we surrendered now to COVID-19? Are we just letting this thing completely fly?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. I think there's a lot of nuance in a lot of the messages that we have, and the difficulty is communicating that nuance. It's not that we're just letting things fly. And I think some people might interpret it that way, but in the message from the WHO, as well as from other public health leaders, is certainly not the case that the virus is gone, that we don't have to worry about it. But in terms of everybody's everyday life, it's going to play less of a role. So I think that is very important message that has to go out, because if we keep saying that this is an emergency when people don't feel it in their regular lives, we're going to lose that trust, the trust that we didn't have during the pandemic. And if we don't communicate in a way that is congruent with what people are feeling, they're not going to feel that public health officials are transparent. So I think the message that we give have to be congruent with what people are feeling, but also have that nuance that we need, that, you know, shows what really is happening. That, you know, for the most people, the pandemic is mostly a mild disease, but there are still high-risk groups out there. There are still regions of the world that are under-vaccinated or don't have access to good health care.
Yeah. So you're basically saying it's a delicate balancing act. I mean, do you think that the WHO has got it right to I guess, make this announcement now?
I think that's consistent with what's happening around the world, and I think the timing is appropriate given what people are feeling and the lull that we are in right now in the pandemic.
Mm. Jeff, I know you wanted to talk about the implications for of ending the public health emergency on the pandemic treaty. Just to, I guess, set it up exactly what the treaty is and what it aims to do, the International Treaty for Pandemic Prevention, Preparedness and Response. Can you just explain what that is and what the WHO's announcement means for the treaty?
It may not mean much. There's a very important international negotiating group working on the treaty. Governments already had a zero draft on the 1st of February and are revising it. And in terms of technical components, it's a very strong treaty, and I believe it will get better as the working groups continue to revise it. My concern is that there's a lack of accountability in the treaty. So we'll have a treaty that tells us what to do, but not that countries have to do it. It starts with an emphasis on, you know, national sovereignty, and essentially allows governments an out to not follow the recommendations in the treaty. And that was one of the failures we had with the IHR, the International Health Regulations, with COVID-19. So I fear that the lack of an emergency situation, just as we're still negotiating the treaty, can have a negative effect on it. I also understand that at some point we need to end the emergency and, like with other infections, consider them a major public health threat, if not an emergency situation.
Ezzedine, I mean, this puts the onus back on individual countries to manage it. I mean, is that really a good idea? We've seen some governments do better than others. What do you think they need to do from this point on to manage COVID-19?
So I think governments need to keep a focus on vaccination, and particularly among vulnerable groups, and make it very clear who those vulnerable groups are, from the older population to the immunocompromised. And in terms of the pandemic treaty, I think we need to see governments start to budge the same way they did with the International Crimes Court, the ICC, or the World Trade Organization, the WTO, or really even in some, you know, business interests where, you know, it's illegal to spread disinformation that can affect stock prices. We need to make sure that it's illegal to spread information that can affect people's willingness to use effective vaccines. So I think there's going to have to be some ceding of sovereignty in the context of the treaty when it's implemented, because there's a pandemic declaration.
Okay, I want to move on what we did right, what we learnt, what we are continuing to learn from COVID-19. Ezzedine, to start off on a positive note, because I know there were a lot of missteps over the last 3 years, what do you think went right? What did we get right in dealing with COVID-19?
I think I would start with something really very basic that everybody knows, that the masks are working, and that is something, it's really magical. I think in Africa, they come back to that. I mean, people weren't thinking to use a mask, but suddenly the mask was something that is really very useful. Actually, the biggest thing I think really jump in history was actually we were able, with resilience, to be able to have a vaccine in 1 year. And I think that was a great thing and great news. So I think now we know how to identify the pathogen, be able actually to do the vaccine and produce the vaccine. And on the other hand, be able to do the testing and clinical testing and be able to use it. I think the other thing that people knew about, and I think it's very positive, that the telehealth and telemedicine is something that will be here. It's going to be here. We want that or not. It's something that will be here, and we have to invest in that. So I think the other thing is the role of the community. It's something very important. And we knew that if we have some communities that were really strong, we were able actually to fight the COVID without any problem. I think technology and community was something, really a big force behind what we did really right in this sense. Beside that, I think the dilemma will be, and the treaty, as Jeff was talking about, is how really to balance between sovereignty and something very important, and equity. And I think that's a very big issue. And the other thing that we have to talk about, the role of the big pharma, but that's another question that we can come back to.
Yeah, indeed. We'll get onto that in a moment. Dr. Tang, I guess just sticking with the vaccine, I mean, looking back over the last 3 years, is it still quite remarkable that one was able to be, or not just one, but multiple were able to be manufactured and distributed to vast majority of the world in such a short time frame?
Yes, that has been an amazing achievement in terms of the benefits of the pandemic and how it spurred our ability to develop vaccines in such a short time, manufacture them in such a short time, as well as, you know, the discovery of antivirals that were effective against SARS-CoV-2. So those are going to be lasting legacies for us going forward for future pandemics, as well as for other diseases that might be amenable to those types of pharmaceuticals.
I guess the flip side of the vaccine is the anti-vaccination movement, which, I mean, in some parts of the world spread almost as fast as the virus. Jeff, why do you think that was? Why was there so much resistance to not just the vaccine, but also just taking general practical health advice from health professionals like yourselves?
Yes, I think that goes back to the lack of trust in governments, the lack of trust in the public health system. And that comes from probably a lack of investment from governments over the past few decades, where some of the safety net of countries have been have less investment, so people don't feel as a part of the country or feel that the government is in it for them. So I think that is probably one of the roots of anti-vaccine movements, as well as the loss of trust in science and moving towards anti-science type messages and people exploiting some of those feelings and those beliefs for their own economic gain. So I think the pandemic has exposed a lot of these, you know, longstanding issues in our society, longstanding inequalities in our society, and that has been very evident throughout the pandemic. And these are things that maybe the public health system wasn't quite ready to address, that we didn't realize how much misinformation, disinformation, how strong the anti-vaccine movement was. So I think those are things that going forward, we need to focus more energy on.
Jeff, how do we reverse that? I guess the mistrust, the growing mistrust in the medical and science communities for inevitably when the next pandemic rolls around?
Well, I think it requires a reinvestment. I think some of these things are happening at the global, international level, as well as within countries. We have to reinvest in many of the things that keep our societies together, not just public health, but education, as well as social welfare systems, all those things that make our societies work and make it fair so that people trust the government and feel invested in all these collective efforts that we need to do against public health emergencies, whether it's a pandemic or something else. So I think there has to be a lot of reinvestment back into the people and getting rid of some of these, addressing some of these inequalities, not just globally, but also regionally.
Yeah. Jeff Lazarus, if you could name a country or a couple of countries that did a good job and explain why they did a good job in dealing with the pandemic.
You know, some of the countries that did a good job in the beginning, at least, for example, was Denmark, which had a real whole of government approach. So not just the prime minister or an epidemiologist speaking, but also ministers in education, labor, foreign affairs, explaining to the public in weekly press conferences what was happening, what needed to be done, how the public should react, and what decisions the government was taking. So I think countries, you know, like Denmark, like New Zealand, like Finland, are some of the, you know, strong examples of a government that really spoke as equals to their population and engaged, you know, also down, as was mentioned, at the community level and really got the public to understand that we're in an emergency situation and we're not going to get out of it, you know, without their actions. And if I can just add on the anti-vaccination comment that was made earlier, while it is a very serious threat, the global studies, the global surveys over the last 3 years have shown an increase in the population willing to get vaccinated. And I think what took many of us in the public health field and other fields by surprise was, you know, the intensity of anti-vaccination messaging. And it's really because of the spread of the internet. And often it's been traced to a few people and a few groups that have been able to, at an incredible speed that we haven't seen before, send out misinformation to the public. So I'm not so sure that it's, you know, there is mistrust in government and there is some mistrust in the science and the new technologies that's being addressed. But I think what we really need to address is how quickly misinformation and disinformation, intentional false information, can spread around the world and in many different languages.
Ezzedine, I want to talk a little bit about, I guess, the first world countries and their ability to, I guess, at least get vaccinations and testing to the majority of their populations compared to some of the developing nations, especially in Africa. I mean, that's surely got to be one of the major things that needs to be worked on whenever the next pandemic does roll around.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. But I think I have to come back to the communication side, actually, in Africa, because I think we have two countries in Africa that's played a big role in transparency and actually communicating information. That was great to have that. I think South Africa played a big role actually in giving the numbers and about Omicron, and I think it helped a lot. And everybody should remember that in the beginning of the pandemic, lots of information was to really share. And I think one of the problems was that. But I think coming back to your question, I think in Africa, are we getting ready for the next pandemic? I don't know actually if we are coming out of this one, because the numbers are not here, the communication is not here, the transparency is not here. But the thing that the WHO, I think even the developed country should come to Africa, because with 1.3 billion people, most likely the next pandemic will be coming from Africa. I think we were lucky that Ebola stayed in Africa. But everybody should think, if there is a variant or a virus coming from Africa and there is no communication about it, and suddenly we have it all over the world, I think the notion also on the concept of One Health should be really applied to all countries. If you are really not caring about what's happening in Ghana, or in Morocco, in Tunisia, or in Sudan these days, because Africa has other problems. There is a war actually in Sudan. Actually, if we don't help these countries actually to have information, to have infrastructures, to have awareness actually, and communicate with them and educate them, it's gonna come back to bite the world. And I think that's something we have to think about it. Maybe we can act locally. That's something that every country is doing. That did it actually in the beginning of the pandemic. But we know to coming out of it, you have to have some equity, because we weren't treated the same way in all over the world.
Yeah. Dr. Patrick Tang, I mean, are we better prepared to deal with the next pandemic, do you think? Or any of the lessons that we may have learned from this one might be forgotten by the time the next pandemic does roll around?
Well, certainly we have made incremental gains as well as substantial gains in terms of technology pharmaceuticals and our knowledge of public health for dealing with the next pandemic. So I think, you know, from that point of view, from the science point of view, from the medical point of view, we definitely have made gains and we will do better from that point of view next time. But from probably the social and the human side of things, I think we still have work to do there. Because without that trust, without people engaged in some of these collective efforts to stop the pandemic, it's going to be difficult. No matter how good your treatments are, no matter how good your vaccines are, you still need people to trust the system and to be on board with whatever process we're going through. Mm. So I think there has to be more focus on that as well, not just the science, not just the medicine.
What happens to COVID-19 now? I mean, it's still obviously, might not be a global emergency, but it is still a threat. What about long-term immunity and new variants? Are they still a very real risk?
So we always say, you know, is it possible? Yes. Is it probable? We don't know. So with the virus circulating, variants of interest and concern are possible. So we have to continue to be vigilant. We have to continue to be sequencing new cases. We need to maintain close collaboration between governments. And we need to remember that millions of people are suffering from long COVID, and that we have not fully understood and uncovered the way we have with SARS-CoV-2. So while there have been great medical advances with the vaccine and the treatments for severe symptoms of COVID-19, we're still far, far behind in addressing long COVID, as well as, I think, in general, addressing what will happen if there is a new variant of concern. Will an emergency be called again? How quickly can we deploy vaccines to those who have not received them, particularly in low-income countries?
Mm. I imagine all three of you are going to agree with this next point, that it's obviously vitally important to continue funding public health to try and stay on top of any outbreak and make sure it doesn't become a pandemic. Azzedine, do you think that we've got too short a memory, though? I mean, if in a decade or two decades' time, you know, this is such a horrible 3 years for people all around the world to deal with on many, many levels, that people will just want to park what happened and move on with their lives. And how big a risk is that?
I think it's a very big risk, actually. I think I'm not going to, I'm really, I don't want to be pessimistic, actually, but I think it's going to be in a decade or so that we are going to see a virus coming back. But I think it's how we'll be ready for it would be the question. But I think short memory, we can see it in everyday life, things that we do. You do, I do, everybody's doing right now. We came back actually to the normal life, forgetting about a lot of things. But still, and I have that to say that COVID is still killing people. Long COVID is still here. But I think we have to fight the COVID now, but think about the next pandemic. I think scientifically talking and being very humble, the virus is coming and we have to be ready.
What are the chances of there being another pandemic, in the years ahead? Is there a greater chance of that happening now, or with the knowledge that we've been able to gather over the last few years, does that put us in a better position to deal with any outbreak that may crop up?
So I think one thing that people don't understand is that outbreaks happen all the time. Epidemics happen all the time. They don't always come to the global public's attention. So inevitably, there will be another pandemic, whether it's 5 years or 10 years or however many years away from now. So I'm hopeful that many of the things that we've made advances in will make it a little bit less of an impact on our population. And I hope also that the young people who are probably the most affected by this pandemic, the generation that had interruptions to their education, to their social activities, that trauma from the pandemic will have some positive effect that, you know, as they grow up, they will remember this and they will take better action when the next pandemic happens.
Well, hopefully that is exactly what plays out, or even that there isn't another pandemic like the one we've just seen to deal with in our lifetimes at least. Thank you so much for all joining us, Azzedine Ibrahimi, Dr. Patrick Tang and Jeff Lazarus. We really do appreciate your time. Well, thank you too for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Tom McRae, and the whole team here, bye for now.